You know other people are going to listen to this, right?
Not this part. I mean, just Lions
will listen to it.
Lions is listening right now. Creepily.
No.
Hi, what? Lions.
No.
Hi, Lions.
He's doing... Oh, well, I guess in the future.
The living room's dark, save for light being cast from the big TV screen and the imminent sunrise that's teasing the one starry sky with whispers of morning.
Glazer!
George?
How you doing, buddy?
I'm good.
That's good. That's good. I am very excited for us to start our new podcast. The podcast called Nostalgia Goggles, Absent Lions, because we're feuding, because he refused to acknowledge the fact that Ocarina of Time was a great game. I think that's the full working title. I don't know. You'll prune that. You'll prune that down, right?
Wait, is that why I'm here?
Shh, shh, shh. Don't ruin this. Don't ruin this.
You know I also got my coffee.
All right, let's move past it. Anyways, so okay, so we instead of playing a video game, we watched the movie.
Yay.
Woo! That movie was Superman the movie, not Superman 4 Quest for Peace, not Superman the Return of Superman, not for the love of God, Man of Steel. No, this was Superman. I want to say the OG, you know, there were Superman movies before it, but really, realistically, this was the Superman movie. Like, when you think of Superman movies, this is probably the movie you think of.
Yeah, there were a couple of Superman movies in the 1950s and one in the 1940s, but this was the Superman movie that spawned a generation of superhero movies.
Yes. Yes, because it had Christopher Reeves playing Superman, and he will always be my hero. You know?
I mean, I do have to say, I never liked Superman as a character. I never understood him, and I never understood how he could have a secret identity where it's just putting on glasses until I watched this movie as a kid. Like,
yes.
Seeing his performance of it made me understand and believe in Clark Kent Superman.
Clark Kent, the Superman. No, and actually, so that actually leads nicely into your nostalgia experience for this movie. When did you first see it?
Honestly, I don't remember exactly when. I know I saw it when I was a kid, but I couldn't give an exact year. I mean, this movie predates both of us by a lot, so it could have come in by any point, at any point in my childhood. But I'm pretty sure my dad rented it. Because that feels right. Because my dad was the one who, we would just go to Blockbuster and like just work our way down, and anything that we hadn't seen that looked interesting in the action movie or horror or new release shelf, we would just sort of grab. So at some point this came up, and I probably was not old enough to understand or appreciate it, but I sat down and watched it, and it was awesome.
Exactly. No, it's good. It's good. Yeah, actually, interestingly, so this is one that my father owned. And so cute side story. My grandmother, I had a Superman, not like onesie, but outfit, you know, when I was seven, like Superman pajamas, right?
Yeah.
But so I had Superman pajamas. Okay, who doesn't, right? I mean, Chuck Norris wears Superman pajamas. So that's all true. But my grandmother sewed buttons onto the neck and buttons onto a Superman cape. So that way I could snap a Superman cape onto my PJs.
Aww.
And my dad and I would watch Superman the movie and Superman 2, you know, the two good ones, just until the cows came home, and pause it regularly for me to run about the house like a madman being Superman.
Oh, that's incredible.
And yeah, man, I mean, it's just, you know, there was just so, and to be fair, there was a lot about this movie that I did not get or understand back in the day, but I don't know, man, it just, it really canonized for me the idea of, you know, a hero, and that was super important to me. So I may have a little bit of difficulty being objective with games like this and Ocarina of Time, you monster. But the important thing is that that's kind of my nostalgia experience. But I was really interested to sit down with you and honestly, because I did try to put all of that stuff aside and really evaluate it as a movie. And I was honestly a little scared to do so because I was really worried that it wasn't going to hold up. And I mean, because to be fair, so far with the movies we've done, you know, Mortal Kombat and Mortal Kombat 2 and with two varying degrees of success, I was like, maybe this isn't so good. So so not to bury the lead, let's dive in. Visuals. Yeah. This movie had them.
Well, most movies do. I can't think of a movie that doesn't, by definition.
That's legit. That's legit. It seems to be a core piece of the media. It's like saying a book without words, but yes. Mm-hmm.
But yes, visuals. I have notes about that.
Go on. No, pray tell, please. Like,
so, okay, so the big thing that I noticed, which I thought was really interesting, and I think I said this while we were watching it, is the way they did the visuals, I felt like we watched four different movies in one.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
There's the first section where they're on Krypton, which is aesthetically completely separate from Clark's childhood in Smallville,
mm-hmm.
which is aesthetically completely separate from Clark Kent, man about town in Metropolis, which is completely separate from the adventures of Superman that come at the very end. Like, it really does feel, and I think mostly through visuals, although we can talk about audio and stuff when we get there, very, very distinct in the way that it's shot, in the colors, the costuming. Like, every aspect of it feels very, very different, which is interesting.
No, I agree completely. And actually, I did not recognize it until you pointed it out to me. But yeah, because, like, on Krypton, like, the visuals are very stark and sterile and white. And then when you get to Kansas, they have a lot of wide panning shots, which I do want to put a pin in and come back to later. And then, like, when they're in Metropolis, you know, it's very clustered and congested. But then when Superman is at the very end, like, being Superman, especially, like, when he, you know, when the climax happens and he's, you know, deciding to use all of his power to basically make the world into the world he believes it should be, they all kind of come together. You know, mm-hmm. all of those different visuals do. And I think that was, you know, purely intentional.
For sure.
So like, one of the things that you noted that I thought was very interesting, which is that, and I never really thought about this in movie making until you mentioned it. And I was like, and I'm going to scroll this away and remember it for later, which is they, in Kansas, particularly when Superman is, you know, a teenager, right?
Mm-hmm.
They use a lot of wide panning shots, right?
I do remember saying this, yes.
Yes. No, you said this. This was you. And I thought that was very interesting because the idea is that Superman is, for all intents and purposes, a god, right? He's very powerful, but they constantly juxtapose him from being small in the world that he's in, not only narratively, but visually as well, which I didn't really pick up on until you said it. And I was like, yeah, Superman does seem a lot bigger when he's Superman. And he seems bigger, not because of because of the things he's doing, because of the shots that are taking, right?
Well, and they use it in really smart, like, instances. So, like you're saying, with Clark Kent in Kansas growing up, just as good old Clark Kent, who's hiding his powers. It's, you know, you mostly get the standard, like, Hollywood waist up, shoulders up shots of people as they talk and interact with one another. But the first time I noticed that is when Pa Kent dies, which we'll talk about more later, I'm sure.
Oh, yes.
Because he drops and mm-hmm. you see Clark run to him. But from the moment we know that he is gone, that he has passed into the next realm, whatsoever that may be, all we see is from a distance.
Yep.
We see Clark run out of the barn, and I don't even think we get much audio at that point either. It's just this very big, wide shot of him and Ma Kent running to see what happens. That makes them feel, like you said, very small in the landscape. And later when he goes to, when Ma Kent goes to talk to him while he's standing in the field, similarly, it's this wide shot of him out in the field. And it comes back again later, most notably when Lois dies. Mm-hmm. Slash doesn't really die, but at first you think she's actually...
Dude, spoilers! For this 40-year-old movie.
Literally, exactly a 40-year-old movie. Where when he like finally gets her out of the car and is holding her, it cuts back out to that wide shot.
It does. Yeah, and that's I think is very interesting, is because like you said, is that after it does all the wide shot stuff, you know, from the initial thing, we always see Superman close up, relatively, you know, being Superman. But then again, it like reminds you visually, like, hey, don't forget, like, he's still small. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the interesting things that I think that they drive home visually, is that he's still small, even though literally he just pulled the earth back together. Like, that is a thing that he did, and it's Tuesday, you know? Like, that's a Tuesday for him.
Well, they do a really good job of making Superman not feel like a god, which I really appreciate it. Because, like you said, one of the problems with Superman, and you know more because you are the true Superman fan here, which, by the way, I'm really disappointed you're not wearing your Superman shirt.
I know, but I'm wearing the shirt you got me, which I thought you'd appreciate.
Aww, I do appreciate that, but it's the wrong Messiah figure from pop culture.
It is true. Yeah, for those of listening who can't see, I am wearing my Goku shirt, you know? Which either Superman wants to be Goku or Goku wants to be Superman, one or the other. But anyways, we're talking about gods. Go on.
So Superman has this problem, and has sort of historically always had this problem of being a little overpowered, a little bit, mm-hmm. just a little bit. But the movie does a good job of making him still feel human and identifiable. Like, this is a man who can lift, pretty much whatever he wants. He can lift a 747 with his bare hands. No big deal.
If I remember correctly, at one point in the comic, some of Superman's feats of strength is A, moving the planet Earth out of orbit, holding a black hole in his hand, and with help, to be fair, like, he and one other person of known strength lifted a book with infinity pages. To be fair, the other person's super strong, so they were probably lifting 100 tons, and Superman was lifting the rest, which, for those of us at home, is infinite pages. He's infinitely strong. Like, but to be fair, I think that Superman can be summed up in a Simpsons quote, which is, so Marge and Homer are walking around fairgrounds, and Marge says, "See, Marge, I told you they could deep fry my shirt." And Marge says, "I didn't say they couldn't. I said you shouldn't."
Okay, I'm aware of this quote. What does it have to do with Superman?
It's because it's not whether or not Superman can. It's whether or not Superman should. That's Superman. That's the part that everybody... And we'll get more into this in, like, plot. But I think that they're driving it home visually, which is that, you know, like, it's like... It's not whether or not... Like you said, like, he's basically a god, but they drive home the fact that, you know, it's like, yes, he is. He can do anything. But the difference is that he cares and therefore is subject to, you know, dealing with all of that. So it's not whether or not he can, it's whether or not he should and therefore will. But bearing the lead, more on visuals. So to bring it back a little bit, one of the things I completely forgot until we started watching it is the actual opening. Which is, in all honesty, I gotta say, and I love this movie, the opening was a little clunky. Like,
well, the opening is just an exposition dump. It's the backstory of where Clark is from and what is up with planet Krypton and who are his parents and why is he on Earth in the first place. And it is very clunky, and it almost feels like, I don't know if they did this in the 70s as much as they do now, where you're setting up
cocaine?
A sequel.
Was it cocaine? Did I get the cocaine reference?
Congratulations.
Woohoo!
Anyway, ignoring you now. So it felt like that sequence was mostly in there to set up a sequel, because one of the big things that happens is you see Zod and his companions get sent to the Phantom Zone.
So real fast, I'm not actually even talking about that opening. That opening was all...
See, there's so many different levels to this movie that feel like different movies that I forgot about that. But you're right, there is something that happens.
Right. So basically, so the weird thing is that it opens via a stage, right? Like it opens like you're watching a play to a comic book being read. And then it eventually goes into the Daily Planet, the Daily Planet symbol, which is then immediately bypassed into the opening credits, right? Mm-hmm. So like I said, like that, all of that was clunky, right? Because that is what we call in the business two separate framing devices, right?
Right.
So now we, the audience, are watching a play of a child reading a comic book of the events that are transpiring. And I would maybe forgive it if it wasn't for the fact that it never comes up again, ever again, the entire movie. So why were any of those framing devices necessary? They literally could have just opened with dun-dun-dun, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun- music. We'll get there. But like, you know, they should have just opened with the opening credits, and we just would have been like just 100% an Eskimo. We would have been super into it. But instead, like, they opened with the dual framing device, and we just all have to live with that.
Okay, I have a theory about this.
I have a theory. It could be bunnies. Go on.
Okay, so I didn't do any research to see if this is true or not, because you guys don't do research, and I didn't want to set...
No, good. No, if you did research like you do on your channel, by the way, Erin Glazer has her own channel. It is Movie Medicine. Check it out. It is amazing. She does a lot of research and it's super informative. But because she's a true champion, she did none of that for this show. So go on.
I looked up the Wikipedia article list of Superman movies, and that was the extent of the research I did for this, which felt.
And that's long. Almost too much
for you guys.
Yep. Wait, for who? For us, right? There's no other. Only Zool. Go on.
I can't ignore that Zool came back on your back.
Just let this happen.
Just for the record, I didn't agree to this. Moving on. Okay. I have a theory about the framing device.
Go on.
What I liked about that is it reminded me of watching Disney princess cartoons as a kid. Because I don't know if you remember this, but a lot of the old Disney movies started with like a physical book opening and a narrator talking through the events of what's going to happen in the books. So I'm trying to remember which ones it actually was. I think it was Snow White.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Sleeping Beauty. I think it was Cinderella. And I want to say Robin Hood. They do that too. But a lot of the old school Disney movies start with that, with the book opening and the narrator reading it out. Because back then, kids' cartoon movies weren't a thing. Like, Snow White was the first feature-length animated film, and nobody thought it was actually going to work. Everyone was like, no, nobody's going to watch that. Kids don't watch movies. Like, that's too much. Bring it back.
Yeah, so I wonder,
kids don't have the attention span for movies. What do you think this is, 2018, with your YouTubes and
said my child, who literally badgers me about watching videos on the YouTubes on my phone.
Hi, Teddy.
Teddy is. Go on.
But anyway, so I wonder if this is something that they pulled from for this movie. Because to be fair, I don't actually know. I didn't do research. You're welcome. But I think this was one of the first superhero movies that really got big, like in a general pop culture sort of way.
Yes, I would agree with that, because I also did a little bit of legwork. Shh, don't tell No one. Doesn't matter. They're not here. But no, I did a little bit of legwork and I think that because we looked it up together where neither of us could find a truly like iconic superhero movie before this. We found some really deeply disturbing stuff in the looking up of those superhero movies, but we didn't find anything like truly iconic before this one. We found a couple of like haphazard Supermans, a couple of haphazard Batmans, some deeply disturbing other things, but like this was really the one that set the tone. The next one that would like the next superhero movie that would really, you know, break the blockbusters was
Tim Burton.
What'd you say?
Tim Burton?
Yeah, Tim Burton's Batman. Yeah.
Okay, don't hurt yourself.
I thought you said Tim Horton. I'm like, dude, they make donuts. Weirdo.
Yeah, let's get in those references for your Canadian listeners.
Canadanian, and yes. So anyways.
So I think that's one of the reasons they use that device in this movie. Because comic books, historically, have been for kids. So making comic book movies back then, I imagine, was still a gamble. And sure. It was something that was mostly like for children. So why not use a device that has been used successfully for other kids' movies to open this one up?
Love it. Love everything about it. But then also the theater framing device.
I don't know and I don't understand and I don't want to think about it. So
no. Okay. I'm going to double down on your thing. So the comic book thing, it's like, it's all for kids, right? It's all for kids.
Mm-hmm.
Love it. Love everything about it. So I'm just trying to think of superheroes who were canonized by their visit to the theater. Well, I know Bruce Wayne went to the theater with his parents. So is that,
are you trying to make this dark?
Yes, I'm trying to make this the Dark Knight. No, I'm just saying that are we all Batman, like watching the opening to be like, no, I want to wear spandex and fight crime and be a superhero. And oh, God, my parents died.
Okay.
Anyways, it's
okay,
fine.
Okay. I just want to make it very clear what you're implying is that the movie that Bruce Wayne was watching with his parents the night his parents got murdered was Superman, the movie in 1978.
Then why else would he be so focused on killing Superman and suddenly aghast by the fact that they share the name of Martha? Anyways, I'm sorry, we're going on. So, so one other thing that I just wanted to mention that I think is we've mentioned it, or I've mentioned it, because I'm the only person that has hosted this podcast until now. But mentioned the fact that it's really, really good when you have a mechanical thing shift tone. A good exemplar of this outside of this movie would be the new Star Wars Episode 6. I think, where basically a sun is being extinguished in order to power the cannon that blows up the world. I don't care. But the point being is that as the story goes on, everything gets darker and darker and darker. So as the tone of the movie gets darker, the visuals get darker, and that's supported by the narrative, right?
Mm-hmm.
Superman does a similar thing, which is that in the very beginning with the end of Krypton, right? Krypton's red sun is doing things. I don't know. They're not really super clear. Krypton's sun is doing stuff that
imploding. Is that what they say? I feel like this movie did not get its canon properly figured out before they started filming. Cause I feel like they say a couple of different about things
cannons because Superman's chest deflected the cannons. Okay.
Right.
But anyways, no. I mean, okay. So to be fair for this movie, it's a little sloppy by our standards because they didn't expect power nerds like us to be dissecting it 40 years later. Like, we're going to do a movie. It's going to go into theaters. It's going to be fun. But anyways, but one of the things they did was they had all the sterile white visuals of Krypton, and then when Krypton started to end, it was because their red star was exploding, so therefore they redshifted everything. So because of that, it created this interesting tonal shift because all of a sudden everything's saturated in red, which makes sense because their red sun is exploding, but it also very distinctly sets the tone. Mm-hmm. And again, it's that in conjunction with like what you said with their the wide shots and the visuals. To me, again, somebody who has watched this movie a million times ever since I was a child, drove home the fact that it's not just something that I loved as a child, but something that like really people put thought into, you know, like they really thought about it, you know?
Yeah. No, the way that they use color throughout the whole movie is really beautifully done, especially with Superman. Because like you said, with Krypton, it's all black and white. It's all very monotone. Everything is very, not boring visually, but like they have this aesthetic. And this aesthetic has no colors in it. Just that's the way it is, except for that one random green crystal that I still don't understand, but whatever, it existed. And like you said, at the end of that sequence, the red sun blowing up, the only other thing that has any color in it is baby Superman's whatever he's wrapped, baby blanket, whatever he's wrapped up in, which is blue and red and yellow, which are Superman's colors.
And one other thing that we have to touch on, which was your observation, which is, okay, so this is back in the 70s, way pre-CGI, right? Mm-hmm. But they did a number of very interesting, smart things that scaled the visuals, because obviously they had to use models, right? Mm-hmm. Because they didn't have CGI. And they also didn't have whole planets to devote to this movie. But one of the things they did was the
like Krypton, Marvel does nowadays.
What?
Like Marvel does nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, so like, you know, Krypton's prison system opens up. It's like a big dome, you know? Mm-hmm. But it opens up when Zod, who are the other two? Lurser and Bator? That's not right. It's Zod.
They did not make enough of an impression that I wrote. That's that fine. I realized they had names.
Lurser and Bator is definitely from Star Trek. But anyways, Zod and his cronies are all standing there. But they did a shot specifically that showed them against the background and then just showed the background. But they did a very good job taking the bridging the gap between models and reality, which I thought is actually kind of lost nowadays on a lot of movies, considering the amount of CGI.
Yeah, well, I'm a huge proponent of practical effects in movies, just because your brain, even when the CGI is as good as it is now, like modern CGI is amazing, but there's a part of the human brain that can just tell when something's off. Like, it doesn't have the same weight and substance to it that you get with physical prostheses or models or something that's like, that exists in the world.
I mean, literally all day, every day, we spend looking at other people's faces, and it's super important for our survival that we interpret all of it correctly. So the minute that something's off, our brain says, hold up. And we're like, oh, shit. Oh, no, wait. Do we need to do something? Do we need to fight? Do we need to flight? Do we need to make love? I don't know. Like, you know, so like the minute that all that's off, our brain like lights up like a firecracker saying, hey, something's weird. And then we're like, oh, right, because it's all not real. But all of that takes you out of the moment. Practical effects tend to subvert that because our brain kind of says, no, all of this is real. And then the higher cognitive functions say, you know, it's not, but you kind of dismiss it unless it's like, you know, fourth wall shattering. But yeah, specifically, the way that they handled the prisoner exchange, the Phantom Zone, are we going to call it that? Let's call it that. The way they handled that, I thought, as you said, you pointed out to me, did a great job scaling this, you know?
Right. Well, so they have, for folks who haven't seen the movie or don't remember the scene we're talking about, because to be honest, I forgot this entire opening sequence on Krypton happened at all.
To be fair, you were pretty drunk.
To be fair, I was pretty drunk when we watched it this most recent time, but when I watched it before as a kid, I'm pretty sure I was sober. don't know. Not certain,
like though. 10. Just pretty.
Pretty positive. Pretty strongly positive.
No. Just pretty sure. That's fine.
But anyway, so they put the three of them in their hilarious hula hoop jail technology where you can't step outside of that hula hoop that's rotating around you, which shows that you're in jail.
I don't like your tone with the hula hoop technology.
It was okay. I know the 70s were a different time. And to be fair, I know you were very distracted by the ultra low V cut of Zod's prison jumper.
Plunging V is thrown around all too much these days.
Oh my gosh. So anyway, we pan away from that and you see the whole top of this dome structure that they're in open up. And it's like this sudden faraway shot where you see the dome open and you can just see these little tiny, like ant sized figures in the middle of the hall where the magical hula hoop jail technology is. And that's when you realize just how enormous Krypton is as a planet, as a world, as an infrastructure period. Like this dome is football stadium big. And we would have never gotten that sense of scope and scale unless we had gotten that wide shot of it. Because it also gives us a really good grasp of how advanced Krypton is. Because let's be honest, hula hoop technology is not that impressive. I don't know, maybe the 70s were a different time and everyone was like, ooh, they got that hula hoop technology though. That's awesome.
Dim hula hoops.
Dim hula hoops.
With a Z.
But it's to see that level of infrastructure is a really good shorthand for being like, hey, Krypton's really cool. We've got a lot of science and technology and stuff. You should.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if this society can't figure this stuff out that's going on right now, the Earth would be totally screwed.
So, long story short, the moral of the story is the visuals have a couple of odd gaps. But long story short, they do some interesting and very fascinating things that were definitely not industry driving. The industry had dealt with it before them, but this is certainly the first time that superhero movies were taken seriously enough to demand those kinds of visuals. Mm-hmm. So, sound.
Ooh. Are we
going to
sound?
Okay, so sound. Yeah, so first of all, just something that we have to acknowledge. We just have to talk about it. John Williams is the man, right? Can we just all take a moment of silence and talk about how awesome... Wait, take a moment in silence and talk? I don't know. Let's just all take a moment and think about how awesome John Williams' score is for this show. Because if any time, at any point in time, you say to somebody like... Yeah, like Superman. Like, what's the music that had to go dun 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 dun? You know, like they know it. Like, this is Superman's song. This is the Superman music. Like, dude, people do it even when they're not doing Superman. Just being heroic. This is the heroic soundtrack. It's amazing. You can't okay. Like, literally, the movie could be hot garbage aside from this one soundtrack, and you would have to acknowledge how awesome and iconic the soundtrack is.
Oh, yeah. No, the Superman theme is, like, God.
No. You're good. The Superman theme is. Most importantly, because like you said, the thing that I think that you said is the most telling is the Superman theme. Because as we said, there have been Superman movies before and there have been movies after. But there is the Superman theme. And it is the theme from this movie, man. That's the Superman theme. You cannot argue with the music of this movie. It is infallible.
This is true. Not to pick on the more modern movies, but I have a feeling we're going to pick on the modern movies a lot. I could not tell you what Superman's music is from Man of Steel or Batman v Superman. Like it,
sure.
It was so muddy, it doesn't stick out in my mind. But every time Superman was doing Superman things, the music suddenly became the Superman music. And you were very aware of it, but not in a bad way. it just, like, you could feel yourself getting really excited. And you're like, wait, why am I getting so pumped up? Like, yeah, I know this guy's doing cool things, but I watch superhero movies every day, because at this point they basically release superhero movies every day. But, like, just that, oh God, just all the,
yeah,
everything.
It's the Superman. And actually, because they play it at the very beginning during the credits, which last forever, which is another one of my complaints, is it lasted for, like, I was like, oh good, the credits. So I got up, I went and made myself a sandwich, I made myself a drink, I came back, sat down, and said, oh, it's still happening. I went out, I walked my dog, I paid my taxes, I bought a house, I lived to be a ripe old age of 80, and I came back, and we watched the rest of the movie. So it's fine. The opening crawl is a little slow. But that being said, to be fair, the Superman music was playing the whole time. So I was like, I super wasn't, like, worried about it, because I just wanted to have more of that. And then they very judiciously don't really play it again in earnest until Superman is Superman. You know, they hint on it. So, like, they drive home, they're like, hey, this is amazing music. And you're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then, you know, they're like, okay, now a little hint, you know, like when Superman's, like, leaving Krypton, like a little bit. It's okay. Get a touch. But then when Superman, you're like, oh yeah, I get that sweet, sweet Superman music. But you only get a little bit. But then when Superman's saving people, you get the whole thing, and it's amazing.
When I made a note, and now I can't find it, but we hear the Superman music when the first time we see him.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember if it's the first time we see Superman or if this happens later, because for some reason this is lost.
You get it when he's first Superman.
When he's first Superman. Like, but there's a part, I think, later in the movie where Clark Kent is clearly about to go be Superman again, and he looks at, like, a phone booth, and the music starts playing, and you just are like, well, I wonder what's going to happen next.
No, that was the OG Deadpool, like, looking at a telephone booth and being like, because he does, he runs forward, looks at the telephone booth, and, like, shakes his head like, obviously this isn't enough cover. Clearly this is inferior. And then he moves on. And that was like that was the OG fourth wall break wink to the audience. It's like, nah, we get you. It's not going to be like that. It's going to be a little bit more realistic. But nah, shorty, we there for you.
That's good stuff. Other than, like, the theme in and of itself, one of the other music things that I had was, okay, so Clark Kent grows up knowing that he's different from all the other kids because he can bench press a train and stuff. But it's not until he finds that green crystal that he knows that he's, like, an alien, and finds the ship and goes and does all that sort of
He knows he's, like, superior, but at that point, like, I think that, because at that point, like, Pa Kent's, because he has his family structure up until then, where they're like, no, you're cool, like, you're different, but you're here for a reason, you're superhuman and all this sort of stuff. And it's at that point where he's like, maybe more than that.
Right. But so, okay, so he finds this crystal, which is the key to him sort of unlocking his true self, like, figuring out who he really is. But the music during that scene is super ominous. I don't know if you noticed that. No. I know you
were trying to listen. Though, right?
So I watch a lot of horror movies. That is something that I love. It's a genre I really love. I think horror is amazing. We can talk about that some other time when people who don't care aren't listening. But so he gets that, and it's, like, it's very horror movie music. Like, I found myself automatically being like, oh, is something about to happen that I do not remember? Like, is something bad about to happen? You're terrible.
No, I'm the worst kind of person. Hey, by the way, if anybody wants to hear Aaron and I sludge through terrible horror movies, you know, just upvote this video, you follow us, and join on Patreon, and we will do that for you, the listeners. Go on.
That was really it. is I don't know why it was so ominous. It was weird.
Okay.
Stop it.
So, no, I just Stop because it. because we have to bookmark the chapters, and now this chapter will be bookmarked by. Okay, so normally we would talk about, like, you know, game mechanics, things like that, but we're going to talk about, like, plot, all that hotness, and now is, I think, the time for us to talk about Metropolis versus New York.
Yes. Okay. Thank God. So this entire, all right. So this is, I actually just watched a great video about this, about how the DC universe likes to sort of have its cake and eat it too, where it's like, oh no, we're totally set a totally different version of Earth. And isn't there a comic book where they actually find our version of Earth at some point?
I don't know. Probably. I'm not a doctor, but yes.
You're failing me. But anyway, so like, why do I even keep you around, George? You can't remember things like that.
I'm so pretty. That's why.
That is true.
I am the prettiest.
That is your most admirable quality.
That is my only admirable quality. Go on.
So, okay. So the DC comics are like, listen, everything significant happens in made-up cities. That way we don't have to deal with real-world consequences, but we can still have fun references to real-world things. And, like, literally, it's having your cake and eating it, too. So it's not like we're not in New York. We're in Metropolis. It's not New York. It's a totally different city than New York, except that they clearly shot it in New York City and just used B-roll footage of New York City. And it's everything about it is New York, except that they keep calling it Metropolis. Like, I feel like a crazy person.
Okay, so first of all, you are a crazy person, but you're not wrong. So the reason why I wanted to leave this out until, like, plot and stuff is because, you know, the visuals are of any metropolitan city, like, that is okay. But, and I didn't even notice this until you started, like picking at the scab, which was, well, like,
because there's that one say, part,
you know, oh yeah, you just gotta go down to New Jersey, it's about a 2-hour drive, and you, like, looked at me like, 2-hour drive sounds like they're in New York.
Well, and there's the part where they're at a train station. It's like, next train leaving for Buffalo. I'm like, Buffalo, New York?
You mean Buffalo, New York? And, like, there was at least half a dozen times where you, like, called it out to me. And I was like, yeah, no, that's legit. And then there's the part where Superman and Lois are flying through the sky. And they were like, and Lois has, like, this, like, super weird internal monologue, and that's fine. But like, the whole time you've been priming me the whole time, where you're like, oh yeah, like, but it's totally not New York. And I was like, they're flying around the Statue of Liberty. They're flying around the statue. It's not New York. It's New York.
The best part about that is I've gotten so desensitized to it at that point that I think my brain was just automatically like, yeah, no, forget it. Like, they're in New York. So when you're like, oh, hey, Statue of Liberty, I was like, yeah, of course it's the Statue. No, they're Metropolis! I got you, movie. I got you. I knew it. I knew you were going to mess up big time. You were in New York.
It's New York. It's New York. It's fine. I mean, I got to say it's Metropolis, but it's totally New York. But yeah, man. Other plot stuff. What you got?
There's so much plot stuff to talk about, but since you brought it up,
I have two significant plot items, but I want to hang on to them. So it's your go.
Well, since you brought it up, we can talk about Lois Lane's weird, like, romance novel internal dialogue when she's flying around with Superman, where she's all like, "OMG, does he like me? I hope he does. We're flying through the air. Is this what you feel like all the time?" And they also, like, dress her in that super girly gown, even though she's mostly wearing, like, very, very business-like. I mean, at one point, she's, like, wearing a tie in the office, and she wears, like, these, like, faux button-down, like, outfits and, you know, trousers. She's, like, marching around, being really awesome and businesswoman. And then in this one random scene, she's just in this, like, diaphanous, flowy gown, like, thinking to herself, like, I'm just gonna slip him a note. It's just got two little check boxes, and it's going to say yes and no. And I'm just going to say, do you like me? Like, that's what it felt like. I'm like, why is Lois Lane suddenly a 13-year-old who doesn't know how to handle their feelings.
No, to be fair, though, like watching that scene where she's like, do you eat? It's like, yeah. Yeah, that's...
Like, that's what do you want him to eat, Lois?
Yeah. Yeah, no, dude. I mean, she is, to be fair, she is 100% an Eskimo for Superman.
I mean, she literally asked him, can you see through anything? And then her super professional reporter follow-up question is, then what color is my underwear? That is a line that made it into this movie.
Yes. And then he says, I'm sorry, I can't see through lead. And then later on he goes, pink. What? Pink.
And then she's all embarrassed and flustered. I'm like, girl, like, you need to hide it a little bit, okay? Like, second date, at least. Come on.
Again, you know, like, I'm not, you know, I'm just saying that I have never been in the presence of somebody who could lift a mountain or, you know, like, I'm just saying that it's not okay. So,
okay, if Superman was real and you met him in real life, would one of your first four questions to him be, what color is my underwear?
No, I mean, I don't know. Like, it's very complex and confusing. I don't know. Like, it's complex and confusing, and that's the thing, you know? Like, I'm okay with it being complex and confusing, but what isn't complex and confusing is the awesome thing that they do with the, I want to say the visuals, but it's not visuals. It's the amazing, immaculate acting of Christopher Reeves.
Christopher Reeves comes
back as Clark Kent.
Oh, Christopher Reeves sells that. That is like, and here's the thing. So with the nostalgia goggles, going back to that, I didn't remember a lot about the movie. I remembered that scene perfectly because it is so just, oh God, he does such an incredible acting job.
He was, man, because he did a great job as Superman. So basically he comes, so after like, you know, the whole flitty monologue of like, oh my God, I'm so into Superman. Superman's the best. And he like lands down. He's like, okay, got to go by. And then Clark Kent comes in, he's like, oh, hey, Lois, you said we were going to go to dinner and blah, blah, blah. And she's like, oh, no, I got to just go get ready. And she's still completely starstruck by Superman, right? And then you see, you know, him go, like, you see him, like, kind of contemplate the idea of, like, telling her, like, who he really is.
He takes off, so, you know, he's got his little dweebish glasses on and everything. And he's all in his little Clark Kent awkward, I'm a tall man who hates being tall, hunched over pose. And then he watches Lois go into the other room, takes off his glasses, and just straightens up. And that's it. Like, that's the only thing he does. But all it takes is those two gestures, and he becomes literally a different person.
And the one other thing he does, which is he changes his voice. And we knew that he changed his voice because because we were watching it with the subtitles on. Remember
that? Right.
It said, Superman voice, Lois. It's like, yeah, actually you do need that change, you know? So it's like, yeah, but like literally he's like, Lois, I blah, 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 blah. And then it's like literally with the change of his posture, taking off the glasses and changing the voice, he became Superman. And he wasn't wearing the suit. He just was Superman. And that's just Christopher Reeves all the way down.
Christopher Reeves as Superman, as Clark Kent, does an incredible job, because there's a bunch of different little scenes that they intersperse throughout the movie of Clark Kent, like, over the top being Clark Kent, like what Superman imagines the average guy to be like. So, like, in his interview for the Daily Planet, there's a part where what's the name of the guy who runs the Daily Planet?
J. Jonah Jameson. No, it's just J. Jonah Jameson.
No, that's the Spider-Man.
It's Perry White, you animal.
I mean,
it's J. Jonah Jameson.
Anyway.
So Jameson hands says, him a soda. Superman.
I want a picture of Superman and open this soda can for me, or this soda pop for me. Because that's apparently what they did in job interviews in the 70s. Like, okay, anyway. So Clark Kent, like, goes to open it, and then, like, you see him stop and go, oh, wait, would the average guy be able to open this can? I don't know. I better play it safe. And he, like, struggles dramatically to open the soda, and eventually Lois has to get it open for him.
Yes. Love it. Love everything about it. It's great. So there are two things that I just need to touch on about this movie. And unfortunately, one of them has to be juxtaposed against the newest of movies, Man of Steel, right? I hate to bring garbage into a nice household, but we got to do it. If for no other reason than for the amazing juxtaposition. So we have to first address the fact that Pa Kent in the comics is alive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So unlike with Spider-Man, Pa Kent doesn't have to die, right? He can die. He doesn't have to die, right? Mm-hmm. So that means if you make Pa Kent die, which is entirely fine, it's a legitimate decision. It's a decision that you as the storyteller are making. And again, that's entirely fine. But let's juxtapose the way those two decisions are made. So let's look at let's look at Man of Steel. So how does Pa Kent die in Man of Steel? Glazer, you wanna fill in the blanks?
There's a tornado, and they left their dog in the car or something stupid. And even though Pa Kent's like, you're not allowed to use your powers to save people, he's like, you know what I should do? Go sacrifice myself to save this dog. Which, to be fair, I understand his reasoning. It's dogs. We don't deserve dogs. Dogs are the best. But so he goes to save the dog, and the tornado moves closer, and he sees Clark start to come towards him as if he's going to use his powers to save him, and he just holds out his hand and he's like, "No, let the tornado take me," and just gets carried away for reasons,
right? And then later battered to death by the random other things thrown about by the tornado. Neat. So, but the moral of the story is that, first of all, you have a human who's oddly okay with their immortality that I haven't seen generally. But also, too, it is most importantly a thing like if Superman decided to, he could easily have saved Pa Kent, right? Yeah. He just like zipped in there, zipped out, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't to save his identity, I guess. I don't know.
No, it was because it was his dad's dying wish that he not do it.
Right. Which he immediately refutes at sheer virtue of meeting reporter Lois Lane. I don't know. It's fine. But so all that's fine. You can definitely make arguments for the fact of like why that's meaningful. I disagree with all of them and you're terrible people, but you can make arguments for those. But then as you touched on before, how does Pa Kent die in this movie?
Random heart attack.
He dies of a heart attack, man. And I think that's so deeply important to the Superman story is that Superman, it's not whether or not I don't care whether I didn't say they couldn't, I said you shouldn't, right? Literally, this is one of the few things that Superman can't save. He cannot save humanity against ourselves, physically or philosophically. And we're framed it physically in the beginning, because he literally can't save Pa Kent against himself. And then later on, the main struggle is him saving humanity against humanity. Not aliens against aliens. It's humanity against humanity. And the fact that, like, his, in a bizarre way, humanity is called into question, it's checked by the fact that this person that he cared the most about, like literally since he's been on this planet, he's railing against the fact that all of these people don't understand him. But from what we've seen, there are two people that do, his parents. And one of the two pillars of his life, he can't save because he just can't. That's important. It's an important framing device. It's an important limiter of Superman's powers. Because it's not how strong he is. It's not how fast he moves. It's not about how hard he hits. It's about us as people. And I think that's super important.
Yeah, man. I mean, I'm not going to disagree with that.
And so to wrap all of that up, the moral of that story is that it's very important that you... So the problem with Superman stories is that, as a general rule, they're framed as like, well, look at how strong he is. Look at how fast he is. Look at how much he can lift. And it's like, and that's all great, but that's not the point, you know? And somehow back in the late 70s, this director understood the fact that Superman isn't about any of that. It's not about what he can do. It's about what he can't. And so that brings us, I'm just going to keep yelling words at you. That brings us to the next thing, which is the climax of the movie, right? Which actually, so I knew that the thing that we had just talked about, I knew that for quite some time. I've been railing about it for some time, but while we were watching it, this was the one part of the movie where I was like, oh, and there's more betterer and greater reveals, right? Towards the end, because you know, like we said, as about up until now, so not whether or not Superman can, it's whether or not he should. But then they actually put Superman in a situation where he's doing everything he can. He is literally disempowered by Kryptonite against Lex Luthor, who has beaten him with his mind. Again, Lex Luthor didn't hit harder. He just literally looked at Superman and said, "Congratulations, you played yourself." Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then Superman is basically, he's done, man. He's got a kryptonite necklace and he's literally drowning, right? All that he has really done up until this point is given an interview with Lois Lane where he says he always tells the truth and he's trying his best to be the champion of truth, justice, and the American way, right? That's basically what he's got going for him. Drowning in water in the thing that literally the only thing that can kill him, right?
And he saves a bunch of people's lives too. Like that happened. He did do that, and he saved that cat from that tree that one time.
He did. He's done all of these things, but realistically, all of California is about to die, and he's just gonna end here alone, drowning. Right? Lex Luthor has won, and it's almost like a side note. Lex Luthor passes by his gal Friday, who, having stated that there are two nuclear weapons, Superman, not just one. Even with you, with your great speed, could have caught one, but there are two. And there's one going for the objective, and there's another one going to some weird place in New Jersey. Who cares? And as Lex Luthor is walking by his secretary, she says, "My mother lives in Hackensack, New Jersey, where the second bomb is going." And Lex Luthor impatiently looks at his watch, looks back at her, and shakes his head, "Not anymore," and moves on. Because realistically, the point was to beat a god and execute his plan. And he has accomplished all of that. He is a walking, talking pinnacle of everything we'd want to achieve. He has ripped Apollo from his chariot and he has won. But then Miss Tessmacher, who up until now has been framed as a ineffectual, lackluster subordinate to Lex Luthor, frees Superman because she makes him promise that he'll save New Jersey, Hackensack, New Jersey first, and she knows that he never tells a lie. And he agrees to it, knowing what the ramifications may be. So ultimately, the problem isn't that Superman is all-powerful and Lex Luthor is trying to curtail it. The point isn't against people who are born human or born inhuman. The thing is that Superman is more human than Lex Luthor could ever hope to be because he tries to save everyone. And Lex Luthor could have won if he had just, like a normal average human, have remembered that one of his closest allies had family where he was literally about to destroy. It is humanity that saves the day, not Superman. Sorry, I mean, I'm done monologuing.
Are you good?
I'm good.
All right. Sly Dog, you got me monologuing.
Yeah. Oh, and also, too, there is definite monologuing in this movie.
All Lex Luthor does in the movie is monologue. That's
he
it.
He does.
He gets no dialogue. He only monologues.
He does. He does. And there's one other thing that we mentioned that we wanted to touch on, which was the flying so fast that it reverts time thing.
Oh, are you going to say the headcanon that you found online?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So basically the idea is that, so you see Superman like just hammering it out, like flying as fast as he can around the world. The world starts going backwards and it reverts time. And a lot of people have been like, well, that wouldn't do that. But the idea is that Superman is traveling so fast that he is actually able to himself move through time. And we are simply being given privy to the visuals of the Earth also moving back in time relative to him. So the idea is that he moves fast enough that he moves back in time, not that he's spinning the Earth backwards, which would not revert time.
Right. Well, and I like that when you said that, it makes so much more sense in the context of the movie, because there's that part then where he drops Jimmy off. And he's like, all right, I'm going to go save Lois. Lois is dead. So he goes up and he flies around the Earth as fast as he can, goes back in time, comes back down. And then when Jimmy rejoins them, he's like, hey, man, like, you just left me on the road back there. What the heck? Which implies that, like you said, he just goes back in time. So that there's a point where there's two Supermans on Earth concurrently, one who's saving everybody else and one who goes and saves Lois.
Right. So he is literally in two places at once.
Mm-hmm. Which, no, that makes sense.
Yeah, which again isn't, you know, it was non-standard at the time. We see way like you know, Back to the Future kind of thing. We see way more of that now, but yeah, no, I think it does hold up. So speaking of holding up,
well, before we do that, I wanted to mention one more thing,
please,
because
do.
We've sort of touched on it a couple times, but I think it's worth mentioning. They do a really good job of creating interesting foils for Superman in this movie. So I specifically want to talk about the way they use Lois and the way they use Lex Luthor.
Hmm.
Because Clark Kent, who we mostly see with Lois, still is a part of Superman. It's not the complete package, but it still represents his idealism, his almost naivete, like, the way that he thinks about the world and wants the world to be. And he can sort of get away with that mindset because he's literally invulnerable. So he never really has to deal with a more pragmatic view of humanity, set off against Lois, who's this like super New Yorker type personality. New York, it's not Metropolis, it's set in New York, God. But she's like the classic cynical, hard-boiled reporter who's going to get her story and works hard and has a very cynical view of the world and the way that the world works. I mean, the part where they get mugged in the alley, she's the one who's like, no, I'm going to fight this guy. Let's do this. And Clark's like, no, like, we don't have to, we can talk our way out of it. Like, we don't have to hurt anybody. It's great. Like, we'll figure this out. And Lois is like, no, I'm going to kick him. I'm going to kick him as hard as I can. And it's watching the way that she changes through her interactions with him, it does a really good job of also giving us a part of why Superman is so important. Not necessarily as a hero, but as a symbol. Because you see this very, very cynical personality become less cynical and a little more idealistic because of her interactions with him.
Mm-hmm.
That during their interview, before she asks him what color her underwear is, she asks him, like, what are you all about? What's your shtick? And he gives I stand for truth, justice, and the American way statement. And she literally laughs in his face.
Right, yeah. She's like, that's ridiculous.
And then she realizes he's serious and like kind of sobers up a little bit, and it makes her stop and think. And I love that because it's so easy to fall into those really cynical perspectives of like, the world is just messed up and everything is awful. And there's nothing we can do about that. Like, I can't do anything about these systematic problems in the world. They're just a fact of life. And Superman as a symbol, as a character, is there to show us that if we still believe we can make a change, we can do that. Like, he is sort of the pinnacle of that because he has strength and speed and all this other stuff. But that's what makes him so powerful, ultimately, is his fervent belief in the goodness that's inherent in humanity. And we watch that change Lois as a character over the course of the movie, which is awesome. And then on the flip side of that, we have Lex, who, like you said, like, their whole thing is their relationship to humanity. So Clark, well, Kal-El, Superman, all he really wants is to find a place among humanity. He doesn't want to set himself above it. He wants to help. He wants to be a productive part of society. Lex, on the other hand, all he wants is to grandstand and be given power and superiority over others. And so through their interactions, you're sort of ultimately setting up a fight between those two different viewpoints. Mm-hmm. Like, which is better? Which is going to win out in the end? This, like, egomaniacal narcissism versus this fervent belief that humanity is good and that if we work hard and work together, we're going to make this great change and create a great society. And that's what makes the story so satisfying, is you, not necessarily because, like, oh, the stronger guy totally won. It's because right.
the
symbol
hit harder.
Right. It's not that. It's Batman v Superman. It's a symbol of all that we want to believe in, all of the best parts of humanity winning out against all the worst parts of humanity. That's what makes it a good struggle, and that's what makes it a good movie. And they did a really good job of setting all of those points up with his relationship to Lois and Lex. That's it. We can move on now.
No, that's legit. No, I agree completely. Like, I think that again, you know, it's just the idea that Superman. So one of the things that you know, the DC has, like, pinnacly powerful heroes, and Marvel has way more relatable heroes, and all of that's great. And I think that's ultimately why Marvel is more successful, is because they have more relatable heroes, which makes it very easier to tell stories, right? But I think that in the attempt to make Superman more relatable, you rob Superman of what he's supposed to be, which is the ideal that we strive for. You know, I shouldn't feel like I am Superman. I should always want to be Superman, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the big difference between Henry Cavill's Superman, you know, where it's like, oh, well, he's dark and brooding and he has things going on. It's like, yeah, no, I get all of that. I mean, I can't lift a truck, but I get all of that. Versus Christopher Reeve's Superman, where I'm like, wait, but what if I just always tried to be that, knowing that I would never get there, knowing I would never be as strong or as fast or as smart or as capable or as understanding or as empathetic, knowing that I would never have all of those abilities. What if I just tried all the time to get there? And that's ultimately what I think that, not to get too deep, where I think that the current DCU has robbed people, which is that they've robbed them of an ideal for the sake of movies. Like, I had that ideal my entire childhood, which was to be this thing that you can't be, but it gave you something to strive for. And so that's where I think that Batman is the same way. Green Lantern is the same way. The Flash is the same way, where it's like, don't make them like people. Make them ideals. And let's all strive for those. It makes it way harder to write for it, but, you know, write a little bit harder.
Well, and I think the modern, in terms of modern DC movies, the one that's come the closest to that was Wonder Woman, which is hugely successful because in a lot of ways, that's what she was in that movie. She was an ideal more so than a character. Like, none of us are ever going to look that good, be that strong, be that
walk
incredibly
out onto
passionate.
A battlefield with a shield and win. But it was, oh my God, it was so good.
But you can see in her interactions with all the other characters, particularly her little group of people who are all very messed up in very different ways, by believing so strong. I mean, one of my favorite parts of the new Wonder Woman movie is the part when Charlie, the sniper who has super PTSD and just can't kill people anymore, when he tries to leave because he's no use to them anymore. And her response is, but Charlie, who will sing to us? Like, that's what makes Wonder Woman really, really incredible as a character, is she believes in people. It's not like, no, Charlie, like, you can still do helpful things. You can still, you know, like, scout it out and, like, keep an eye out for us and watch our backs, which he does throughout the rest of the movie. It's no. You're, like, you have an important part of you that we would be lost without. And it's not about what you can do. It's about what you are. And, like, tying it back, Superman has the same thing. He has the same sort of idealism and faith in people that makes him really powerful. And that's what makes the characters interesting. And heroes, like, I can watch anybody punch anybody. Like, just go onto YouTube and pull up, like, a UFC fight. Like, whatever. That's not interesting. What's interesting is watching people be heroes in other ways.
Watching humans be heroes. Yeah, because it's not a virtue of how hard you can punch. It's a factor of so many other things. And actually, now that you're talking about it, I don't think that Henry Cavill is our generation Superman. I think that Steven Universe is.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Gal Gadot, and now I'm really sad.
No.
I mean, I love Steven Universe, don't get me wrong.
No.
But I was like, Wonder Woman is our new.
I've only seen really Wonder Woman in The Wonder Woman, and that's amazing. That was an amazing movie. I loved it, loved everything about it. The only thing I didn't like about the movie was Ares with a mustache. I just couldn't get on board with it. That was literally my only complaint. Everything else was tens across the board. I had one that was the low point, was a mustache. So that means it's like a 9.9995.
But in terms of male characters, yes, Steven Universe is the modern day
icon. No, I mean, I feel like the Superman hero is changing dramatically. But what I do recommend is that all of our listeners, you know, dive into that for their own. But what we now have to do is ask the question, did the movie hold up?
So the pacing I struggled with a little bit.
Yeah, no, I'll give you that.
It is very slow because it is a 2.5 hour movie, 2.5 hour long movie, which is about on par with like the modern Superman movies. But this one felt like it dragged in certain places in a way that modern movies don't always.
Yeah.
And I know that that's just different. It's like, it's just different times.
It's like, what's the one? House on the Prairie. Little House on the Prairie. You know? You're like, that movie's amazing. Probably could have been like 50 minutes shorter, though.
But other than that, yes. Christopher Reeves is incredible. Incredible and just such a talented actor, and I enjoyed every minute he was on screen, every single minute that he was on screen. It was a fun movie. The bad guys were super campy and enjoyable in a way that I think comic book movies should embrace a little bit more than they do. Lois was awesome. Yeah, no, I loved it. I thought it held up very, very well.
No, I could not agree more. You know, and again, I walked into this with the rosiest of glasses, but I was like, no, we're going to take those off. We're going to watch this as much as it's going to break me. But honestly, like, I wanted to dig at it. And like you said, like, you know, the pacing was not great. The opening was weird and janky. You know, there were a number of places where I've been like, you know, this could have been done a little bit differently. The special effects were actually honestly stellar for the time and actually hold up pretty well, honestly,
especially him flying.
Yes, dude, Christopher Reeves knows how to fly against a blue screen. You just watch him do it. It's amazing. It's great. But anyways, no, I mean, like, it all held up surprisingly well. But honestly, I think that the overall heart of the movie is the thing that held up the most for me, which was just, you know, the message, the idea that it's like, no, it's humanity that holds out. It's not how hard you can hit. It's not how strong you are. It's how human you are. It's the connections that you make. It's living for truth, justice, and the American way. The American way being, you know, give us your tired, your hungry, your wretched masses yearning to be free. I think that this movie just it portrays Superman as a Boy Scout in a way that makes you want to be a Boy Scout. And honestly, if you're looking at like, I want to watch a Superman movie, right? And you have all the Superman movies laid beside you, dude, watch it and watch this one. Don't watch Man of Steel. Man of Steel is hot garbage. Like don't watch that one. Just watch this one. It's good. I mean, to be fair, I have always considered myself to be, you know, like I have always aspired to be Superman. To be fair, though, I don't think, Aaron, we've ever had this discussion. DC Universe specifically. I mean, who's your hero?
Well, I don't know. I like General Leia Organa. Run into that.
No, DC.
I don't understand why you're having trouble with this.
No, okay. No. It is now important to me that you know that what you said is not, it's not DC Universe, right? You know that, right? Like, it doesn't count.
Is it not? Right?
No, look. Are we feuding?
Are we?
We are now feuding.
The curtain falls. The music plays. The credits roll, then it all fades to black. And you're left by yourself. The fanfare is gone. There's no player two there by your side to share victories won. But as you slowly progress down the hall to your bed, a few great events leak back into your head. From the time that you spent traversing the land, battling evil, fighting the darkness, just sword in hand, your memories creep in with the edge of a smile.